You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 46 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin
Pelton. And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
And I have a surprise beer for you on this week's Peltoncast.
This must be an enormous surprise because you, like, specifically tried to keep me out of your fridge so I would not accidentally see it before the podcast.
It's going to be a huge letdown.
I know. The thing is, I have no particular expectations about what it is, but even with that, it's still going to be a letdown.
Okay, let's say that this is like a Luke Jokel surprise, not an Andrew Whitworth surprise.
Or DJ Lang surprise.
But okay, allow me to unveil the surprise beer that I have for you. I don't think you know it's coming.
I don't. I have
but
no
idea.
But
once you see it, you're going to realize that it is apropos twofold for this week's Peltoncast.
Okay. Is it Guinness? Oh, it is a Guinness.
It is a Guinness. And it is apropos told for this week's Peltoncast because not only is Friday St. Patrick's Day, but this week you and I are going to see Men in Blazers live.
We are, yeah. I was planning, I was in the store today and I was like, should I buy some Guinness for St. Patrick's Day? And I was like, no, I'm just going to drink at the Men in Blazers show, drink Guinness. But it turns out I didn't need to for another reason because of the fact that you apparently.
I was worried these would foam up.
Yeah.
And they are. Just protect your computer over there. This is not what it sounds like on Men in Blazers.
No. Apparently they do a better job.
No, yours was a lot better than mine. I drank one of these. These are 14.9 fluid ounces of Guinness Draught. And I drank one of these right before you came here. And I drank it all in one sip.
Oh, wow.
15 ounces in one sip because this has no alcohol in it.
Does it?
4.2% or something. Wow, it's like drinking a Bud Light.
That is shockingly low. That's how you know it's going to be a good podcast, though, when you've shotgunned a beer beforehand.
It's not even... I didn't shotgun a beer. It's basically, to me, drinking Guinness is like drinking water. It is so low alcohol. And I have to say, Guinness, worse than I remember it tasting. This is probably the first time I've had a Guinness in maybe 3 years.
This is very watery. No, I don't think this is like... I don't know. Are you sure this is normal Guinness?
Guinness Draught? I think that's normal Guinness. I think it's just wheat.
It doesn't indicate otherwise, but I don't know.
It's a special edition can, which is why it looks different. I think, here's the thing.
It's not like it's been that long since I've had a Guinness.
I think when I would drink Guinness in the past, say I was 22, 23, 24 years old, since that time period, I've drank a lot of beers that are either very sour or very full of hops. And then you realize, you look back on it, and you're like, oh, Guinness kind of sucks.
Oh, I disagree. Like, I had a Guinness last year on St. Patrick's Day. It was delicious. It was great.
Is this tasting good to you?
Not at the moment.
It's bad, right?
Again,
I'm 28 of these.
Did you? Yeah. Seriously?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't. With 24. I don't know. I really remember liking Guinness.
Huh. All right. Well, I guess we're going to have to learn to like it.
I mean, look, I'll drink it.
Yeah, that wasn't within question.
But it really is very unflavorful. Anyway, so I'm sorry on this week. I'm sorry on St. Patrick's Day and the week that we're going to go see Men in Blazers live that I have negative things to say about Guinness. But this is... Did we drink that terrible Mac and Jack's beer on the podcast?
Yes.
Okay, this is the second worst beer we've ever drank on the podcast.
I think we did, yeah.
Yeah, the Mac and Jack's IPA.
To me, it's ahead of any sour beer, first off. Just right off the top.
You are wrong, sir.
Just right off the top there. We got a lot of sports to talk this week. Should we get into it?
No. We should not get into it.
You're right, we shouldn't.
Are you kidding me?
Oh.
Are you kidding me?
We should get into talking about what's on your hat.
And that is burgers. I told you I was ready to go. I had the burger hat on. I've drank 14.9 fluid ounces of Guinness already.
As you had the burger hat on, when we went to Zippy's Giant Burgers on Saturday night.
I was going to say every day, but that's not true. Sometimes listeners see me and I'm not wearing the burger hat,
yeah.
And they're disappointed.
It's a real letdown. All right, so any background on our outing?
Background on our outing?
Yeah, I don't know. So this is number three.
We got in the car.
This is burger location number three in our quest, our search for Seattle's best burger.
So we went to what I consider there are a few burgers along the way, right? There, I would even say there are kind of categories of the burgers. There are some in the list which feel obligatory to go to, right? There are some in the list...
Like you're only going there because it's obligatory?
Yeah, more or less, right? Like there are some burger places that I've been to that I know are not real competitors for the best burger in Seattle, but we're going to because they're a notable burger place in Seattle.
I suppose, yeah, that makes sense.
There are some burger places that I've never been to before. It's all a question mark.
Yep.
And then there are the burger places which are real contenders for the best burger in Seattle.
So you're saying this is the first real contender we've been to?
And this to me is the first. Well, a Katsu burger may have been a real contender.
It was in the. So you're saying we've done one from each of the categories. Kelly Burger not being a real contender in your mind. Katsu burger being a question mark. And Zippy's being in the competition.
And I have to say, it did not disappoint.
Interesting.
Interesting. Do you have a different take on this?
I don't think my take is as positive as yours is.
Wow.
What rating did you give Zippy?
Well, let's talk through what we ate first. Yeah. So we each had the Zip Burger with bacon, right?
Cheese and bacon.
With cheese and bacon. It's more or less what I would say a normal burger.
Right.
Right? You've got your burger, you've got your cheese, tomatoes. There might have been some onion in there.
There was definitely pickles. A very crisp onion.
And the Zippy's secret sauce, which is a Thousand Island variation, more or less what secret sauce tends to be, right?
Kind of meh on the sauce.
You know, the sauce could have used a little bit more flavor.
Yeah.
I found the sauce to be maybe a little bit too... You didn't notice that the sauce was there necessarily unless you dipped it.
Exactly.
I could have used a little bit more punch to it. Same as this Guinness, right?
Right.
I could have been hit over the face a little bit more with the flavor in the sauce. So if I had to put one mark against it, that would be it. But overall, piece by piece, pound for pound, this is easily the best burger we have had yet.
All right. So to me, the strength here, the patty and the cheese, incredibly flavorful.
Yes.
Which is good because it made up for the fact that, to me, the bacon was kind of a non-entity.
Yeah, the bacon really was almost not even there.
If I was going to do this over again, I don't know if I'd get the bacon. I'd mix it up and get something a little more creative, which we didn't really do here.
Well, the goal was to basically have the burger, right?
I don't think it necessarily is. I mean, that's generally what I prefer in my burger, but I might mix it up the next time I go to Zippy's. To me, the biggest demerit here, besides for the fact that the bacon was a non-entity and the sauce, secret sauce wasn't that great. The burger kind of crumbled for me. The patty kind of crumbled and made it hard.
That's how you know it's a good patty, though.
I mean, that's how you know that it's not overcooked and things like that. But it did make it kind of difficult to eat.
I thought 80% of the bites were more or less perfect bites. I could have used a little bit more. I could have used a little bit more bacon. And I could have used a stronger sauce that just, it showed itself a little bit more, right?
I mean, I still think this was the strongest of the three burgers we've had. I just want to give more room for other burgers to come in over the top here.
Before we give
grades. Much like Sylvester Stallone. I haven't referenced that movie in a long time.
Before we give grades, I want to say just the overall experience of going there was so great, right? Like, it was an accommodating staff. Considering I'm bringing my family with all of their various allergen issues, right? Yes. Very accommodating to that. Seemed like they wanted to be there, knowledgeable about the burgers that they're working with, right? Yep. If I ask them a question about the burgers, they know what's going on. And that to me is always the mark of a place that I want to be at. It's like they take ownership. Every single person takes ownership over these burgers. It's not like you're just a person working at a burger place.
I mean, it's much like we discussed about In-N-Out on last week's fast food special with Nate Duncan. If you... by some chance did not listen to that episode.
That was fun, right?
It was a lot of fun and got rave reviews on the internet, I feel
like. Yeah, I've been thinking maybe you should go.
Nate is surprisingly unknowledgeable about the Sounders.
Does he know about Hydroplanes?
I don't think so. I don't think so. You know, women's basketball, it's going to be tough for him to carry that segment.
I don't like the idea of me carrying this segment.
Exactly. You can't get rid of it. I think he's going to remain he should remain a special food correspondent for us.
Food correspondent.
Yeah. His breakdowns were intricate.
I like the idea of him being like lifestyle correspondent. Human thought process correspondent.
Did you see the tweet? Someone said that they would listen to like a podcast of Nate breaking down every decision in his life.
The process.
He's so analytical about it. And he was like, yeah, that would run so long, though. But anyways, if you haven't listened to that, it remains
Stop timeless. Listening to this.
Actually, keep listening to this, because this one is time sensitive. This one has to stay fresh. That one, that's going to keep for weeks.
Fresh like that Zippy's burger that we had. And what would you give a grade for Zippy's?
I rated it an 89.
89.
Okay.
We're close. I would rate Zippy's a 92.
Okay. Yeah, so that's not so far off.
Comfortably in the lead, but room for some, I would say there's room for another burger place to come in and take that crown.
Yeah, and that's the whole point of this exercise. But, you know, you're not going to be disappointed if you go to Zippy's, I don't think.
So this next week, we're going to be going to Great State Burgers. We're going to be going there before we go see Men in Blazers. In fact, if you, the listener, are going to go see Men in Blazers this week...
I think there's at least one listener that I can think of who there's a pretty good shot will be at the Men in Blazers podcast.
And you're going to be in South Lake Union and want to go to Great State Burgers. Let us know.
Yeah, hit us up.
We'll be there not drinking Guinness.
I might still drink Guinness. I still think Guinness from the actual draft is going to be better than this.
This is Guinness drought. That's basically what they're saying here.
That's their attempt to replicate it, but you know it's not as good.
I think you're underestimating how flavorful.
I don't think I've ever drank Guinness out of a can before. I've drank it out of the bottle.
It's meant to be drank from the can, you know? That's why it has the little thing dongling around in it.
But the dongle is in the bottle as well.
The dongle's everywhere.
Yeah.
Just don't swallow it.
The dongle is in your head. Really. It's in our hearts, actually. That's where it is. So I look forward to that. That'll be another one that is completely new to us.
And I've been a Great State before.
Oh, completely new to me, not completely new to you.
Yes. But I'm curious to go again because I feel like I have a better sense of what it is this time. I went for lunch one time with my coworkers who were maybe a bit naysayers on it, which might have clouded my view of it. And you have never naysayed a burger before. You are a say-yayer.
I've probably at some point in my life naysayed a burger. But yeah, your coworkers, they naysayed the Steak and Shake, which you revisited and re-rated.
I really don't know what I'd re-rate it. I would rate it as not bad.
Is it good enough to be in our list?
No. Well, we're not rating national burger places anyway.
No.
So it wouldn't be in our list because of that. Because it's a national burger place.
I suppose. But they also, what did they naysay? Oh, they naysayed the
Tortas Locas.
Yeah, and that was, it turned out to be a wildly inaccurate assessment. So, yeah, I'm starting to have some questions about your coworkers' food taste. Despite
they've naysayed the band Yaysayer also. But before we move on, I wanted to say we would love to have you participate in the Peltoncast Tournament Challenge, and we have a special prize for the winner of both the men's and the women's tournaments.
Well, we were at Zippy's conducting our search for Seattle's best burger, picked up $20 gift certificates to be delivered to the winner of these pools. Now, the question is, if one of us is the winner, what do we do then?
We're just enjoying some burgers. What do you mean, what are we doing? No!
Okay, we're keeping it?
We'll see when the time comes. If you win, we're giving it away. But if I win,
okay,
we're keeping it.
That's the logic there.
Where can people go to participate?
So either you can go to the Peltoncast website on soniccentral.com, and there will be a link under this episode, or you can go to the ESPN Tournament Challenge and search for Peltoncast. So we already have many listeners signed up. Would love to have you, the listener, as part of this competition.
Does each individual person think that they're the listener?
Yes.
So you mean the one person?
Yep.
They know that they're the listener?
Yeah. You know who you are.
So that you can eat along with us in what is our currently rated number one burger place.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about it. But should we talk about sports?
We should talk about sports because there's a lot to get to this week.
Yeah, weirdly busy week in Seattle sports.
The fact that not many teams are playing.
And that we're completely ignoring the Mariners again.
Apparently Nelson Cruz is doing well in the World Baseball Classic. Is that a thing that's happening?
Yeah, I guess he had. I was talking to my friend Trevor from Comcast Tech Support. he let me know.
You were basically giving him a personal podcast without her. Are you going to replace bringing him on?
Yeah. Me and Trevor and Nate Duncan. Trevor is going to carry the women's basketball stuff. Nate Duncan will be mostly for burgers. And I'll add color. Yeah, my friend Trevor from Comcast Tech Support was telling me that Nelson Cruz had a game-winning hit against the USA.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't have the heart to tell him that I'm cheering for Team Italy in the...
of course. Anyways, the Sounders preparing for their home opener this Sunday against the New York Red Bulls, where they will be celebrating the MLS Cup, raising the banner.
Hoisting the banner.
To the CenturyLink Field rafters to go alongside the Super Bowl 48 banner, mm-hmm. plus in our heads the mythical Super Bowl 49 and 51 and, banners.
And 40.
Oh, and 40, yes. Yeah. Good point. But coming off a thrilling 2-2 draw last Saturday in Montreal that we watched.
Man, soccer's a crazy sport, right?
Often it's not, but in that case it was. And
just
and,
the fact that we were so excited about a goal to tie the game in the last minute.
Yeah. I mean, it was a classic. Like, I considered tweeting the classic Sounders win 2-2.
Really? I mean, I would say a devastating outcome for Montreal in that match.
Oh, yeah. Up 2-0 in the very late stages before they concede a penalty to make it 2-1, and then still leading well into stoppage time.
Yeah, basically, they gave some time after, which I was kind of surprised about. Still a chance for the Sounders to pick up 3 points there.
Yeah.
But basically, on the last kick of the game, Will Bruin coming in, basically cleaning up the mess.
It's a classic poacher's goal, which is what you expect from Will Bruin.
I kind of like Will Bruin.
Yeah. And especially the idea of bringing him on late in games when opposing back lines are a little bit fatigued. They've been dealing with Clint Dempsey and Jordan Morris for the better part of an hour and a half. And then you bring in Will Bruin. You definitely see what the Sounders were thinking there.
So some positives that I would take away from this, right? The main positive to me is the Sounders offense in the last 30 minutes or so.
Once they were really playing soccer, as you like to say.
I really like when they're playing soccer.
I mean, they had some good chances early. I think before you got over to my house where we watched the game, had a couple of opportunities, a free kick just outside the box that Clint Dempsey sent into the wall. And then another opportunity that Jordan Morris, I think, sent wide. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, there was a ball that Jordan Morris probably should have scored on. But just missed the goal. And also Ship being in there on a couple shots.
Yeah, getting his first start in place of Alvaro Fernandez in the midfield. And he made some things happen against his former team, Montreal. So that was nice to see. Just another part of the depth of this year's roster.
You definitely can feel the depth. But I think Brian Schmetzer is settling into what the lineup is going to look like a little bit more. I mean, it's been two matches, but... understanding where...
And you're going to see... I don't think it's going to be the case. Like, last year, after Schmetzer took over, aside from injuries, he basically started the same 11 every week for a stretch there. I guess you had the Dempsey situation where he left, and that forced him to mix things up. But he, like, was very consistent. I think there's going to be more mixing of the lineup this year, and hopefully at some point we'll see Brad Evans.
Sure, I mean... They're going to explore different rosters. Like, it's a long season.
It's so long. When you think back to the guys who were playing this time last year, yeah, and what the lineup ended up being in the MLS Cup playoffs, it was completely different.
But I do like the idea that they're settling into a couple of finishing players, right? And you've got between Will Bruin and Wingo, who's bringing some speed to the outside.
Some pace.
Right? For those last 30 minutes, he might not be the most skilled technical player, but as far as a young player for the Sounders playing in his first and second matches, getting onto the field,
yeah,
there's definitely something there.
I mean, we also saw them go with more pace when they put in O'Neill Fischer at right back for Gustav Svensson, who's probably the more reliable defender, but Fischer's more likely to get forward and join in the attack like you already have Jovan Jones doing from left back position on the other side of the pitch. So... yeah, you can get a lot faster over the course of the game with some substitutions.
Do you feel like this might be a wild miscalculation based upon two matches that you see a little bit of DeAndre Yedlin in there?
I think that's going a little far.
Okay. I just really like the idea of somebody who's coming in. And the way that the Sounders played DeAndre Yedlin,
yeah.
And
he
came in for a little bit of energy off the bench and kind of carrying the team through those last 30 minutes. And then Will Bruin being there just to clean things up. I felt like in this last match, maybe there was some rust on Clint Dempsey after playing for the full 90 minutes in the previous match. Felt like he wasn't maybe as sharp as he's been. And it's also kind of, Ladero's had some perfect balls. The ball that set up Jordan Morris on the play that he should have scored on was a perfect pass from Ladero. But at the same time, it feels like he's still kind of figuring out how to play with Clint out there as well.
Yeah, which is an inevitable part of the process. So I think, you know, I would have felt okay even if the Sounders had lost their first two matches, but the fact that they did get salvage a point from this two-game road trip, it makes it feel a lot better, especially because of the fact that now they're coming home and facing one of the four teams in MLS that remains perfect with 6 points through their first two matches, the New York Red Bulls, who are atop the 538 Soccer Power Index projections, which show them averaging a league high 58 points. They're the one team in terms of like team quality that's rated ahead of the Sounders right now. And they've done this despite the fact that they've only scored one goal themselves so far through two matches. So you might be asking yourself, hey, how did they win two games and only score one goal?
You explain.
They've been the beneficiary, recipient of two own goals.
Two own goals? We have to watch for the own goal this weekend?
Yeah, watch out for the own goal. They had a game-winning own goal last weekend.
Okay.
It was the only goal in their match.
The only goal.
Against Colorado, and then also had an own goal in their opener against the expansion team, Atlanta United. But
they were just confused on which net they were on, right?
Yeah. That was much like when you play pickup soccer.
Wait, what are you saying?
Okay, you're right. Your thing is more handballs. It's not necessarily own goals into your own net. I think they will eventually score plenty of goals on their own because they have the last year's leading scorer in MLS, Bradley Wright Phillips, as well as the leading assister, somewhat not coincidentally, Sasha Kleischen. So this is a team that can put balls in the net. I don't know what the right expression is here. That's one of the things we're going to have to learn over the course of the season.
Put balls in the net.
That doesn't sound right, does it?
They're drawing own goals and they're putting balls in the net. Where were the Red Bulls at last year?
Well, they won the Eastern Conference during the regular season and then got upset by, I believe, Montreal.
Oh, so they got knocked off in the playoffs. But this is a very high-quality opponent.
Yeah, and they had won the Supporters' Shield before that. I mean, they're consistently one of the best teams in MLS.
Bradley Wright Phillips is British?
Yes.
And played for Chelsea?
No, I think his brother was the more notable English soccer player, and that's why Bradley came to the MLS to kind of get an opportunity and has emerged as one of the star players.
They should start a podcast together.
Yeah. the fabulous Wright Phillips cast. It just doesn't have the same ring to it, does it? I don't know. It doesn't work. Also, a milestone for the Red Bulls last week, their goalkeeper, Luis Robles, became the MLS Iron Man, starting his 142nd consecutive game between the sticks.
142nd match in a row.
Yep.
Wow, he's like the Cal Ripken Jr. of MLS.
Yeah, he's only, let's see, I think 1,982 behind the record. No, that was actually what Gehrig's record was. I don't know where Cal ended up finishing, but he's got a ways to go for that one. So, excited to...
Are there any concerns that you have going into... Seeing that, I mean, to me, after these first two matches, I think the offense figuring out how to play with each other. The other concern that I have is still this defensive back line.
It just seems endemic to the Sounders that they're going to generally defend well, but, you know, basically switch off for one or two plays a game, and those can be costly. In this case, one of the goals they gave up really was probably more a bad giveaway by Ladero, which left not much cover. And then, as you noted, not a great angle by Roman Torres.
I'm blaming Roman Torres for everything.
Yes.
This is Roman Torres's goat year for me.
Wow. he's your Jermaine Curse.
Yeah, he's my Jermaine Curse for the year.
He's your Daryl Bevel.
I'm gonna hire a plane to fly a fire Torres sign.
It seems mean-spirited.
Should we do percentage chances of victory?
Percentage chance of victory, draw, or loss.
Yeah, that third outcome.
Here.
Let's just say victory.
I guess I would say about 40% here.
A victory? Are you factoring in that it's their first match of the season?
That's a good point, and there will probably be a good crowd on hand. Historically, the Sounders have done quite well when they've got, you know, I don't think this is going to be close to a full sellout. Looking for tickets online earlier this evening, I don't think that. And 538 is much more optimistic than I am. They say 50% chance, 49% chance of victory for the Sounders.
I think given the situation, it's like a 60% chance.
Okay. I mean, like as I said, historically, when they get close to a full upper bowl, the Sounders very difficult to beat and even to draw.
Is it common to play two matches on the road after you've won the MLS Cup?
Well, as we talked about earlier on the podcast, it's because of the fact that they were conducting some renovations to the control room at CenturyLink Field.
Did you tell me this already? And I forgot?
I'm pretty sure I did.
Okay.
I know a lot about this topic.
I was thinking about burgers.
I know a lot about this topic since I'm friends with their director of Game Ops.
Okay.
So that's why they started the season on the road.
I think you did mention this last week and I completely forgot about it.
Not the MLS like disrespecting the Sounders or something like that.
All right.
Which also, weather-wise, probably will turn out for the best, I think. Should be dry on Sunday.
Really quick, do we want to do a quick little rundown and then finish up with a Seahawks free agency?
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's start with Husky football.
So the Husky Pro Day was this past Saturday.
Yep.
And not the kind of news you want to see from Pro Day, with Sidney Jones going down doing a backpedaling drill, and the immediate assumption was that it was bad, and it turned out to be is he suffered a ruptured Achilles. I mean, that's...
It's not really Husky news, and it's not really Seahawks news. It's more just Sidney Jones news, and it sucks.
Yeah, we should pour some of this Guinness out. You won't mind losing it.
We should pour a lot of this Guinness out.
For Sidney Jones, it's brutal because, you know, the way the NFL draft works, you're committed to the draft once you declare. You can't go anywhere. But obviously, the fact that if he comes back and plays at all this season, it won't be till the end. And I think, you know, being a rookie and trying to get up to speed, everything like that, I think you probably just draft him looking at this as a redshirt year, and you're thinking about getting him in 2018. But this takes him from someone who was a near certain first-round pick to much more questionable draft stock at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think my hottest take on the situation would be that I think Sidney Jones is going to get drafted higher than a lot of teams think. I think there are teams who looked at it and said, look, we had Sidney Jones rated as the number 15 guy in the draft. Maybe we can get him here. And I think that if there's going to be... All it takes is one team, right? And I think that there's going to be one team who sees Sidney Jones available in the early to mid second round and pulls the trigger there. Some team who's willing, has the kind of roster and is willing to take to take a year off for Sidney Jones.
There is one team in particular that I think is more likely to make this pick than any other.
Who's that?
It's not the team you're thinking of.
The 49ers?
No. They fired Trent Baalke. He's not there anymore. It's the Cleveland Browns.
Oh, the Cleveland Browns.
Because think about it. First off, number one, who has a ton of second-round picks? I believe they have 4 second-round picks after making the Brock Osweiler trade.
They just paid $15 million for Sidney Jones.
So that he could not play for them this season. And then also a team that obviously is not prioritizing winning now.
Yeah.
And
they're winning forever.
An analytical organization that probably is going to be thinking about things from that standpoint. So they've got, I guess they've only got 2 second round picks. That doesn't sound right. Maybe that Houston trade hasn't updated on Wikipedia yet. I think they have 3 second round picks and then also the top pick of the third round if he gets that far. So they're at, I believe, 52, 57, and 65.
I love the bold prediction of the exact team who's going to take him.
Well, see, the beauty of it is if it's not the Browns, no one will ever remember this. But if it is the Browns, I can come back and play the clip.
I don't know if the 76ers necessarily intentionally did this, but it seems like they often had players. They were drafting players. If we're assuming that the Browns are the 76ers of football, they often had players either who they had already drafted and then got injured, but Embiid was injured before they drafted him, right?
Yeah, and is when Nerlens Noel. It was
2 players, yeah. And they were drafting those players in the top 5. In the NFL, you're looking at a second-round pick.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense. I just think most teams are unwilling to wait for that. So,
well, even if he's not drafted by the Cleveland Browns in the second round, I think there'll be a team who has the kind of roster who's willing to wait for Sidney Jones for 1 year, because you're still getting he may be different after the injury, but you're still getting first-round talent with a later pick.
Do you think the Seahawks would be willing to do that given the fact that they already have an injured cornerback, not technically on their roster right now, in Deshaun Shedd, who remains an unsigned free agent, but almost certainly will be signed at some point?
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think if it wasn't for the Shedd situation, it would make a lot more sense for the Seahawks.
I mean, like, would I be shocked? Obviously not.
No.
Was there news about Kevin King or John Ross, any of the other players who were involved? It seemed like they generally fared pretty well.
Yeah.
Honestly, the Sidney Jones injury feels like it bumps Kevin King up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, they're at the same position. So if you're not going to take Sidney Jones and you have your heart set on a cornerback, then maybe Kevin King is that guy.
I've now begun to think that he's not going to make it to the Seahawks.
Interesting. I saw, I believe it was an NFL.com mock draft today that had him going to the Seahawks.
Well, I mean, if he's there, I would be surprised if the Seahawks didn't draft him. I mean, you basically couldn't create a more Seahawks cornerback than Kevin King.
Probably not.
And John Ross, he didn't run a 40, right?
I don't think so.
I would never run a 40 ever again. It'd be that episode of Seinfeld, I choose not to race.
Yeah.
I'm never running a distance of 40 yards ever again in my entire life if I'm John Ross.
He's proved everything he needs to prove in that regard. What's the point?
When they were talking about his second run at the combine, it was like, yeah, I guarantee you John Ross is good. He cramped up. He's good. Like, you can only do bad.
Yep.
And you can always tell people about how you could have run faster.
Yep.
But yeah, that pro day, John Ross was not running a 40.
No.
He was not running any increment of 40 yards in a row. Let's talk a little bit of college basketball.
So the Huskies men's basketball season came to a merciful end last Wednesday with a 78-73 loss to USC. They actually played pretty hard in that game for being without Markel Fultz. Gave it a good effort, had a chance into the final minute, but now it's over, and now we await word on Lorenzo Romar's future, which does not sound like it will come until later this week at the earliest.
And we'll have, I think, whenever we do have news about Lorenzo, either way, I'd like to do, almost instantly when we have that news, basically either a future of the Huskies or a year-end constitutional of where is this team going to be next year, knowing that Lorenzo will be back, or who should the Huskies go and get as their head coach?
Right, because that's a pretty big wild card in terms of, you know, if Romar is fired, I think we would see a high degree of turnover in the roster. Might see a pretty high degree of turnover in the roster either way, especially with the fact that the number of guys they're bringing in this year's recruiting class exceeds the number of available scholarships they have, even with Markel Fultz officially declaring for the NBA draft, shocker of shockers, last Friday. The other sort of Husky-adjacent news, some sad news that former UW assistant Cameron Dollar was fired as the head coach at Seattle U after 8 years there?
8 years, my God, that was a long time. It's crazy because if you could give me a time machine to 8 years, I would have told you Cameron Dollar is going to be, first off, probably we thought he was the future of Husky basketball.
Yep.
Also,
I mean, and not just Husky basketball, the future of Husky basketball after Lorenzo Romar inevitably took the UCLA job.
Also, the thought of Cameron Dollar going to Seattle U seems so natural.
Yeah, and, you know, I wonder how much not getting into the West Coast Conference really scuttled kind of the big dreams that Seattle U had. It made it very difficult for them to draw fans to Key Arena. Turned out to be like this cavernous arena for them to play in front of.
I remember going to a couple games. Did you ever go to a Seattle U game?
Yeah.
Not against UW, a random Seattle U game?
I had credentials for a full season 1 year.
Okay.
Like I wrote.
Was that the year I went to the game?
I don't know which year you went to a game, but I did a 3-part series on Seattle U for a website called The Classical and about kind of their aspirations.
That's like the Black D1. Grantland?
No. That is not. It's like the Indie Grantland. Yeah, where I interviewed Dollar at length and, you know, talked about his path. So I'm bummed about this. I really thought there was a path for them to succeed, but it never came to pass. And we'll see what they end up doing. But,
so their goal when they became Seattle U, when they became a Division I basketball team, they came in hard, right? With playing the games at Key Arena. The Graz own the radio rights.
Yep.
Does he still own the radio rights?
He does, yes.
Nice. Probably not the kind of investment that he thought it would be.
No.
And their goal all along was to get into the West Coast Conference.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it made sense. It at that point, I believe, was 9 of the 10 schools were Catholic universities on the West Coast. Yeah,
being a Jesuit school.
Like, they were a perfect fit for that. But Gonzaga wanted no part of Seattle.
Man, in the God, West Coast. Gonzaga! Jesus Christ!
I don't know if they... I think they didn't want another team from the state of Washington in there from a recruiting standpoint. But then especially when Dollar was hired because of the fact that he was a big part of the UW-Gonzaga coaching staff feud that dated to Gonzaga reporting Dollar for recruiting violations, recruiting Josh Heupfeld, which turned out not worth the trouble. Not worth it for either school in hindsight.
Didn't he play in the NBA?
No. He was kicked off the team for drug use.
I think I'm thinking of like an Oklahoma quarterback from like 2000.
But
Josh Heupel?
Yes, that is who you're thinking of. He didn't play in the NFL either, but that's who you're thinking of.
Pretty solid college player.
Yeah.
Would have been worth the feud.
Played in a national championship game. I can't remember whether they won that. Anyways, that's where the feud sort of between the UW and Gonzaga coaching staff started. So that transferred over when Dollar went to Seattle U. And that at that point, there was no chance Gonzaga was ever voting for them. And they wield so much power in the West Coast Conference that they had no chance. And it also happened to be at the time where, like, because of conference realignment, there was no second, like, decent middle tier West Coast conference. So the WAC at one point was a pretty good conference with, you know, Nevada and San Jose State and teams of that ilk in there. Those teams all up and left at about the same time that the WAC
to the Mountain West, Seattle generally.
Mountain West. I think some of them went to the Big West, including Hawaii. And now the WAC is like this random conglomeration of schools that aren't even necessarily on the West Coast.
Yeah, who's in the WAC?
I think like Chicago State is in the WAC.
Denver?
I don't know about Denver. I think they might be in a better conference.
Denver University is in a better conference.
All right, we've got, I've now looked it up. Cal State Bakersfield, Chicago State, Grand Canyon, which is a for-profit university and actually probably the best of these in some ways.
Grand Canyon. Wait, who earned the bid from the WAC?
Cal State Bakersfield got the bid this year. New Mexico State has dominated the conference in recent years in basketball. Missouri, Kansas City, Seattle U, Texas Rio Grande Valley, which is definitely not Western, and Utah Valley.
Kansas City. I mean, I guess they are in the AFC West.
That's still a lot closer.
Like, basically no schools on the West Coast in that conference.
Yeah, Cal State Bakersfield and Seattle U are the only teams that are actually in the Pacific time zone.
Man.
If you want to go by that.
Well, I think both Cameron Dollar and Seattle University learned that it's very difficult to become a D1 school. Things are not as easy as they seem.
So I have no idea who Seattle U is actually going to hire to fill this job or how that person might succeed, but, you know, they're going to try. So good luck to them.
Sure hope it's not Brandon Roy.
There will probably be inevitably some speculation about the possibility of Dollar rejoining the Husky coaching staff if Romar is retained. So I'm sure both him and Ken Bone, who is spending this year as a volunteer assistant coach at Gonzaga University, and
it
was
Gonzaga?
Not, you'll recall, that Ken, the other Ken Bone from the presidential debate.
We're the only ones who read Ken Bone and think of a sweater vested Wazoo head coach, former Husky assistant. Every time I read that, I'm like, oh, Ken Bone in the news again.
So there will probably be a lot of interest in one of those two guys joining the Husky coaching staff, although how they create a vacancy on the Husky coaching staff.
Like, Lorenzo always finds a way.
So
I can tell you it's not going to be Michael Porter Sr.
Much, much to be determined on the UW front. But again, we'll have more on that as news breaks.
Any arena news for this week?
Just a small piece of news that the city council has announced a select committee on civic arenas.
Oh, wait, didn't we already complain about this before?
No, this is
a different group. Okay.
It will be co-chaired by Bruce Harrell and Deborah Juarez from the Seattle City Council. And their first meeting will be to discuss Seattle Center, Key Arena, and transportation on March 27th, followed by a meeting on April 17th to discuss Key Arena renovation proposals after the April 12th deadline for companies to submit those proposals.
So they're focused solely on the Key Arena project.
No, they will also be taking up the Soto Arena when they start to consider the street vacation. It's just a committee to allow the city council to do arena stuff.
Okay, it's the Committee for Arena Stuff.
Yep.
And Bruce Harrell has generally been a supporter of the Soto Arena Group.
Yes.
The Russell Wilson Group.
Yes.
Deborah Juarez has been...
She obviously voted against the street vacation. I don't know how much we really know about her position, but and how firmly entrenched she is in it, but probably not a coincidence that they took one person who voted yes and one person who voted no from on that street vacation request.
Okay. And what about Husky women's basketball?
So today was Selection Monday.
I'm about to fill out my first ever women's bracket.
Yeah. And the Huskies ended up getting a 3 seed in the Oklahoma City region. They don't do geographic regions. They just go based on the city that hosts the regional. So the good news here is the Huskies didn't end up in UConn's region, which is absolutely what you don't want because you're not making the Final Four. The bad news is Baylor, who's in the Oklahoma City region, by statistical projections, generally considered the second best team in the country, and then also has the geographic advantage of the fact that they're playing relatively close to home if they make the regional, whereas UW would be flying across the country. And then also the number 2 seed in that region, Mississippi State, has a similar, you know, not as dramatic, but also has a geographic advantage, which helps make up for the fact that UW is rated as a better team than Mississippi State by... I looked at the Sagarin projections, but the statistical projections in general. The Huskies are actually 5th in the Sagarin predictor ratings.
Really?
Yeah, but just didn't win nearly enough games to merit consideration for both Stanford and Oregon State, who played in the Pac-12 final, finished out of UW in the regular season. They both got 2 seeds.
Really? No 1 seeds from the Pac-12?
No, I mean, I think, you know, Stanford, had Oregon State won the final, they would have had a stronger case for a 1 seed. The committee basically picked Oregon State over Stanford. They're the ones who get to play in the West Regional in Stockton, California, which is, I think, about an hour away from Stanford's campus. So, whereas Stanford got shipped out of town to play in the regionals. So, but as we've talked about earlier, the big thing in the women's tournament is making sure you're a top 4 seed and you have the chance to host the first 2 games in the sub-regional. And the Huskies in that sub-regional will be hosting Montana State, which won the Big Sky Conference after going 15-3 in conference play this year. They're rated number 106 in the country by Sagarin. And it was kind of a tight call for them, even though they were 15-3 in conference play. They had a tight conference tournament. They beat Eastern Washington by 2 in the semifinal, Idaho State by 6 in the final.
This is still a better conference than the WAC.
It's close. They lost 74-64 at Utah in their only game against a major conference opponent. And in their previous NCAA tournament appearance back in 1993, they lost to the Huskies. So some history there. They're led by 5'9 senior guard Peyton Ferris, who averaged 17.5 points and 7.5 rebounds per game. Nobody taller than 6'2 on their roster. So that's kind of the thing you're looking for in Husky opponents is like, can they take advantage of the Huskies on the inside?
No. Nobody taller than 6'2. I have no idea what that means for women's basketball, but like, well, it'd be like an
equivalent
like,
of 7 foot is basically 6'5. 6'2 is more or less equivalent to like
6'7. It would be like they have nobody taller than 6'7 or something.
6'8, probably, yeah. Something like that. So not a real big team.
And they're coming to Heck Ed?
Yes. Okay. So 538's projections, which are probably the best for the women's tournament. I also like them for the men's tournament, but I don't want to give up before we pick our brackets. Give the Huskies a 99% chance of advancing past that first game. So then in the other matchup, this will be Saturday, will be the first these first 2 games, Gonzaga and Oklahoma. Oklahoma the 6th seed, Gonzaga the 11th seed. And Heck Ed has been kind of a home away from home for the Zags in the past. They took advantage of, it used to be that instead of the teams hosting in the top four for a long period of time, you bid to host the first 2 rounds. And then if your team made it, you got to play at home. So the Huskies kept hosting, but their team was nowhere near good enough to play in the NCAA tournament. So they just sent Gonzaga here, and they had like huge home court advantage. And is a 10 seed in 2010, they knocked off North Carolina, who was a 2 seed, to get to the Sweet 16.
Wow. So we could have UW. So what do you think Gonzaga's chances of winning that game are? Pretty good, right?
It's interesting. 538 has them even accounting. I don't know if they're fully accounting. Like, they're accounting for travel, but I don't know if they're accounting for crowd support, which won't be here because obviously UW fans will be at the game on Saturday.
Are UW fans cheering for Gonzaga, or are they cheering against them?
Probably going to cheer for them.
Because they're the lower seeded team also.
Right. I don't know. It's a complex issue how UW fans deal with Gonzaga. I think everyone deals with them differently, including us deal with that differently.
Wait, do we?
I'm generally much more pro-Gonzaga than
you. God, I hate Gonzaga. You were talking about Mark Few and Cameron Dollar. It's like, oh, everything is wrong with Gonzaga.
There's a difference between being pro-Gonzaga and being pro-Mark Few.
Okay.
I know some Gonzaga friends. I have some friends who are Gonzaga fans who aren't that pro-Mark Few.
I don't. They're complicit. but...
So, I mean, Oklahoma is obviously the better team. They were 28th in the Sagarin rankings. Gonzaga's 36. There often is the case that they'll, like, dramatically underseed Gonzaga because of the fact that they don't want, like, a really different, difficult opponent for the team playing at home. That's not quite the case this year. I mean, they're a better team than the typical 11 seed, but not, like, dramatically so. But that should be a pretty good first-round matchup, I think.
The women's tournament confuses me.
Yeah, there's some weird stuff going on. There's some weird stuff going on in the men's tournament, but definitely in the women's tournament. Oklahoma, this is their 18th consecutive NCAA tournament appearance.
Really?
Under Sherry Cole.
18th?
Yeah, they were a power really in the early 2000s. They went to the Final Four one year with Stacey Dales of NFL Network fame as their star. They had Courtney Paris, who was one of the better players in women's college basketball at one point. This year's team, not quite up to that standard. They did go 13-5 in Big 12 play before losing by 24 to West Virginia in the opening round of the conference tournament. They went 2-5 against ranked opponents and lost all four of their road matchups, which bodes well if the Huskies host them. And they have some size. They start a 6'9" freshman, Nancy Mulkey. So that's, if 6'5" is the equivalent of 7 foot in men's basketball, I think 6'9" is like, it's like Yao Ming, basically.
Yeah.
But she only averages 11 minutes a game. She doesn't play a lot. And they don't really have like a star talent. They're a very balanced team with nobody averaging more than 12.7 points per game. They also lost their only matchup against a Pac-12 team. They lost 82-74 to Cal in a preseason tournament on a neutral site. Gonzaga... this is their 9th NCAA tournament appearance in the last 11 years, and they reached the Sweet 16 four of those 8 times previously, including, as I mentioned, 2010. They went 26-6 this year, 14-4 against the West Coast Conference, and they actually beat both Pac-12 teams they played. They beat Wazoo by 18 at home, and they won at Stanford, something the Huskies.
What?
Did not do at home against Stanford. Earlier this year.
That's how shocked I was. Yeah. Spit out my second Guinness here.
And they've got come in with a little more size. They start 3 players 6'2 or taller in the front court, including Oregon State coach Wayne Tinkle's daughter, Ellie, who is one of their senior redshirt senior starter. And then they also have John Stockton's daughter, a point guard.
All right.
As Gonzaga teams typically
yeah.
do. And held really a defensive-minded team. They held opponents to 36% shooting this season. So I could be like a low-scoring, grinded-out affair if the Huskies end up facing Gonzaga, which is not the way they'd prefer to play, certainly.
What would be their chances of winning against each of these teams? Basically, what's their chance of making the Sweet 16?
It's about 90%. I don't think it's dramatically different. Yeah, I mean, that's where 538 has them at 89%.
Make the Sweet 16.
Which is the 7th highest chance.
Wow.
But
And then who did they come against? Who's the number 2 seed?
Number 2 seed, as I mentioned, is Mississippi State.
Oh, okay.
It's a relatively weak number 2 seed. So a decent draw on that standpoint.
So there's a good chance that they get to Baylor, and then all of a sudden they're up against a pretty unstoppable force there.
Right, which is why the Huskies, 538 gives them only a 9% chance of making the Final Four. They've got the 7th best chance of making the Sweet 16, but the 10th best chance of making the Final Four.
Which side of the bracket? Are they on the UConn side of the bracket?
I think so.
Okay.
Let me go switch to that view.
So if they were to go to the Final Four, they would play UConn in the first game than the championship.
Yes.
That's where it would end.
For certain. I mean, if it was a Husky-Husky matchup, that would be pretty awesome.
I mean, like, I've never filled out a women's tournament bracket, but everybody just picks UConn to win, right?
Well, in this case, I think, you know, we might get some UW fans. So people are going to pick the Huskies, but we're just not entirely sure which
one. You're really leaning into the both of the teams being named the Huskies.
But yeah, you basically, it basically is entirely determined by who you pick, like some of the random first round matchups, like the 8-9 matchups. Okay. That's what determines
who hosts the 8-9 matchups?
Nobody.
Those are on a neutral site?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're at the one seeds site.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That checks out.
I'm glad you've got that.
It took a while, but you finally explained the women's college basketball tournament to me.
Yeah, try see if Nate Duncan could do that.
I don't know. He might be able to.
All right. Having discussed that, should we wrap up by talking...
Where did Nate Duncan go to school?
He went to, let's see, he went to Tulane undergrad in Arizona.
Post-grad. Oh, well, I'd love to hear about Arizona.
I'll tell you all about Adia Barnes and the women's basketball team at Arizona. Should we wrap up by talking about Seahawks and NFL free agency? A wild, I would say, first week of NFL free agency. Not necessarily for the Seahawks, but in general.
Wild for the NFL.
Yeah. A lot of money got thrown out to a lot of mediocre players. It's not going to translate into many wins.
I think to me, the response should be if there is a lot of money being thrown around. I think about this with NBA free agency this last summer, right? It felt like there were a lot of teams spending a lot of money on players that are not worth very many wins, right? It was almost like there are all these teams that are kind of huddled in the mediocre world who are basically just spending money on each other's players and players changing teams for no real purpose. And if that is the world that you're living in, to me, the best strategy is to more or less sit it out.
Oh, you're saying the only winning move is not to play?
But the Seahawks played a little bit. They played more than they have in the past. But the places that the Seahawks really do well in free agency is finding the guys who are not getting signed on day one. Day one free agents are almost never, unless you're getting the very top tier. And even then, I don't know, there are a lot of questionable signings at that level.
Yeah, I mean, you look at like someone like Dominican Sue to Miami. Has he really dramatically changed the Dolphins' fortunes? No.
They made the playoffs this last year.
Yeah. Into the playoffs as the sixth seed. Did they ever have a chance of like doing it?
You could also look at like 10 different major free agent signings for the Dolphins.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Is that there's like a cycle of it, and the Seahawks are like generally out of that cycle, and yes. I like that.
Where you want to be in free agency is the guys who are on the second week, the third week. People who just linger out there, like Michael Bennett. They got Michael Bennett deep into free agency. Cliff Averill, they got deep into free agency. These were not players who were signed on the first day. For some reason, it doesn't really make any sense to me right now.
Nope.
But I don't know if NFL teams were able to see exactly the value of those players, and that's where the Seahawks are looking, right?
And I don't know if those kind of bargains are going to exist in this year's free agency because most of the quality players have already been snapped up, but that is where you see them shopping in terms of the one position that hasn't been very active so far, running back.
Yeah, have there been basically any running back signed?
I'm trying to think. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head, any running back of note.
Which makes sense. I mean, the NFL has gone through an understanding of the value of running backs the last few years. Basically, NFL teams are catching up to what football statistical analysts realized about running backs, and that is that most of them are integral, dependent upon the passing game, dependent on your line and your offense. There's individual running back ability. There is such a thing, but it's very minor.
All right, so the four guys who either have visited or reportedly have visited or are visiting, we talked last week about Adrian Peterson in the Nate Duncan podcast. We've got Jamal Charles, Eddie Lacy, and then Latavius Murray. So do you have any preferences? It seems like the Seahawks are probably, the fact that they're having all these guys, bringing all these guys in, seems like they're probably going to sign one of them. So you can't say you can't say your preference is not signing any of them, which I think would be our inclination in terms of spending on running backs.
Well, I mean, it's not going to be big money. The fact that these running backs remain on the market at this point means that there's not a lot of money being thrown around. We can agree on that, right?
Presumably, yeah.
For some reason, I mean, I guess it makes sense if everybody can. Offensive line is where the money is going.
Well, the other thing, someone asked Bob Condotta this on Twitter. You know, if this is considered such a deep draft for running backs and tight ends, why are the Seahawks looking at those positions in free agency? Well, the point is, if other teams are thinking, oh, we don't need to sign someone because we can draft someone, yes, that creates a better price in free agency. I still don't know if that necessarily means you should get an aging running back, but like it, the value is still created by the draft.
I guess it's a tough call for... I can see an argument. To me, Jamaal Charles is probably... I think his playing career is mostly over.
Probably, but he's one of the two guys I'm most interested in because of the fact that he at least has been an extremely effective running back in the past, and I think that he will come very cheap.
I think they're all going to come cheap.
I'm not convinced they're going to come that cheap.
I guess that's what the question is how cheap any of these running backs are. Like, if you can get Adrian Peterson for near the veteran minimum, you should probably sign Adrian Peterson.
Probably.
But to me,
Peterson just hasn't been that effective in recent years. Like, even 2 years ago when he ran for a bunch of yards, his DVOA was basically league average.
But you can just release Adrian Peterson if he doesn't have it anymore.
I suppose that's
true. That's the thing. To me, the one who had probably like the most would be Eddie Lacy, because he is a running back who's more or less in his prime, has had good seasons before, and it depends on what the price tag is. But if Eddie Lacy is coming at a decent amount, I could see him being somebody coming in and splitting time with, if you have Lacy, Rawls, and Procise, this is not a bad backfield.
Yeah, to me, he's the best fit for the Seahawks style of running, and also was by far and away the most effective of these running backs last year when Charles and Peterson were basically injured all year. Latavius Murray, to me, no interest in whatsoever. I don't think he's ever had an above-average DVOA in his career, and he was running behind one of the best lines in football last year, which, you know, part of Peterson's apparent interest in Oakland is playing behind that line, with a pretty good passing attack last year, and yet still was just not that good.
You know we're getting Latavius Murray.
Probably are.
I would say that if I had to rank them percentage-wise up to 100, it's like a 45% chance that it's Latavius Murray.
Also not a receiving threat whatsoever. Charles, at least theoretically, could be that. Was early in his career, not in 2015, the last year that he was somewhat healthy. But, yeah, like Murray, to me, I'm just not even sure he's that much of an upgrade on the Rawls and Procise combination.
Definitely not an upgrade. How is he an upgrade there?
I mean, Rawls was quite bad in his own right last season over the course of the year. So,
Thomas Rawls put together 2 seasons ago one of the best running back performances of anybody in the league for that year. He was maybe the highest rated running back in the league. So I'm not.
Charles, by the way, rated similarly on a per play basis. Obviously, didn't play that much that year,
and is much older and injured for all of last season.
Yeah,
you can't compare Thomas Rawls and Jamaal Charles.
Thomas Rawls has had his own share of injuries, so I don't know if that's a huge point in his favor.
But this is Thomas Rawls going into his third year. I believe in the Seahawks.
This is Thomas Rawls making the minimum. That's the other thing.
Yes. Well, I mean, whoever this is that comes in, as long as it's cheap, I'm fine with whatever. Whatever they want to do, they can. The thing is, you need to always have the flexibility to release a player. And they don't really have the flexibility to release basically their big free agent signing after we saw what the contract was in Luke Jokel.
Well, I mean, I think their case would be that it's only 1 year, so we do have the flexibility to release him if for some reason he doesn't work out. It's more about the alternative cost of the fact that you sunk $7 million guaranteed and potentially $8 million into someone who I think generally not considered even an average offensive lineman during his time in Jacksonville. But this is one you can rationalize.
I can rationalize this hard.
You can rationalize it on performance standpoint.
Yes.
2 years ago, even though the Jaguars decided after that to move on from him as a tackle and move him to guard for last season, before he suffered a major ACL injury that also included his MCL and his meniscus, the so-called triad of terror injury.
And that's when we're signing
it. That's what you usually like to hear about your free agent signings. But Football Outsiders charting only credited him with 3 sacks allowed in 2015 when he played basically a full season at left tackle.
Basically, the decision to move him to guard, we're trusting that the Jaguars made a good decision.
I mean, their offensive line overall was not that good.
When he was there?
Yeah.
In 2015?
Yes. It's just so hard to parse individual blame or credit, which is part of why I don't believe in the great man theory of the Seahawks offensive line where, oh, if they could only sign TJ Lang, it would solve everything.
Oh, yeah.
especially because an offensive line is much less about like who's the best player on your offensive line and much more about who's the worst player in your offensive line, especially in pass blocking, because that's the person who's getting beat and getting creating problems.
Yes, and we've talked about this a lot, but do you think that Luke Joe helps to answer that question?
So my view of the signing, the fact that they gave him a one-year contract, is a lot of it is just a way to let George Fant get another year of experience. Like, develop in practice and not have to have the pressure on him to play. So, you know, John Clayton had a piece earlier Monday saying that Joku could end up at either left tackle or left guard for the Seahawks, which means that George Fant is basically competing against the idea of moving. In that case, it would be kind of a shift of presumably Glowinski would go to right guard and then Jermaine Ifedi would kick out to right tackle. So Fant is competing against whoever would be at right tackle, I guess.
Okay. Okay. I'm okay with that. I mean, to me, I don't think about it in the same way as necessarily he's a bridge year between this and Fant. I think about it more as they give Luke Joku 1 year. The free agent market for offensive linemen was huge, so they had to pay him probably more money than they would have liked to. But they get a chance at basically very low risk because it is a one-year deal, right? At having a potentially rehabilitated Luke Joku. They give him a year to rehabilitate his career. And if it works out for both parties, maybe they pay him money next year.
I mean, that's my big issue with it. Like, I would rather it be a two-year deal with, you know, like $10 million guaranteed or whatever the number would be. Because at least that's the case, you have the upside that if you do rehabilitate him this year, you take advantage of it the next year with a relatively smaller
contract. I
guess
so, but you're talking about somebody coming off a pretty major injury.
Well, that's another reason to not give him $7 million guaranteed. Like, it reminds me a lot of...
But the market bore that out. That's why they had to. If they wanted to make sure that they got a potentially starting-level offensive lineman, they needed to overpay for it. And they could have overpaid a lot more.
They could have. I mean, I don't... That's damning with faint praise. But it reminds me of the Rajon Rondo when he was signed with Sacramento last year. I mean, not in terms of...
Russell Wilson is not Boogie.
Not in terms of, like, the player...
Pete Carroll is not George Karl.
Not in terms of the player that Rondo is and the player that Joku is or the fit in the locker room or all those things. But Sacramento signed him to a one-year contract, and it was like, oh, yeah, we got him at the below-max deal. Okay, great. Like, the best-case scenario is even if he is everything you think he is and he ends up being better than that, then you have to pay him a lot of money to keep him the next year. I don't like contracts like that. I'm just fundamentally opposed to them. Like, if you're getting him for the minimum and then you have to pay him next year, hey, awesome. But you're not getting him at a bargain this year and you're not getting any benefit in year two.
It might be a bit of a bargain.
He's going to have to play dramatically better than he ever has, coming off an extremely serious knee injury.
Okay, so what does the offensive line look like right now? The Seahawks not getting TJ Lang. Seems like they really pursued TJ Lang hard because they must have felt like linemen coming off of injuries were a little bit undervalued in the market.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. So it looks like they're going with the line that they had last year plus Joku.
Yeah.
Which means that they're adding more experience.
Well, we still don't know what's going to happen with Gary Gilliam in terms of bringing him back.
He's tweeting at Jermaine Ifedi right now. Did you see that tweet?
I did see that.
I kind of like that. I was like, Gary Gilliam's feeling the heat. So what does the line look like right now to you?
I don't know. I guess since the Seahawks don't have that player at right tackle signed right now, I guess I would say Fant, Joku, Britt, Glowinski, Ifedi.
Ifedi at right tackle?
Yeah.
I don't like the idea of moving Ifedi.
Well, if you're going to play Joku at left guard,
I'm assuming they're bringing
Gilliam
back.
Ifedi is going to right tackle. That's what's happening.
I assume it's going...
It's not like you're not going to play Glowinski, and it's not like you're not going to play Ifedi, so...
I assume it's going to be Joku. I mean, look, somebody will get injured, everything's going to shuffle, right? But the ideal offensive line going into the year is Joku, Glowinski, Britt, Ifedi, Gilliam.
I think the Seahawks coaching staff is not very high on Gary Gilliam based on the fact that they tried so hard to replace him throughout the season. So I'm unconvinced that Gilliam will end up a right tackle.
But so here's some things about the offense. I'm so sick of hearing about the Seahawks offensive line because I feel like it's almost like a red herring, right? It's like we're so concerned about the offensive line.
I don't think it's a red herring. It's just like no matter... Like, I talked to some people on Twitter who were like, they thought that the Seahawks' interest in TJ Lang was just to try to pacify fans. Like, I don't think the Seahawks care about that. You can complain about the offensive line too.
I can tell you, Pete Carroll and John Schneider do not give a shit about pacifying fans.
Right.
There's nothing they care about less.
They're in the 5-year grace period. They don't care.
I think Pete Carroll might go out of his way to make fans upset. Tell them to toughen up every single week. Toughen up. I don't believe that. They probably wanted to get more experience and depth on the offensive line, obviously, right?
Yeah.
But some truths remain that, number one, the Seahawks offensive line will be better next year.
It would be hard for it to be worse.
Number two.
Seahawks are making regression to the mean work for them.
Luke Joeckel will get more credit for that than he deserves.
That's probably true.
And the offense, number three, the offense is going to be closer to the 2015 offense than the 2016 offense.
Inevitably, just because Russell Wilson, you know, barring further injury,
yes,
will be healthier than he was last season.
There are so many things that are going to be different going into next season that are not just going to be about the offensive line. And all of this credit is going to go to Luke Joeckel.
All right. You made a strong red herring case. I buy your case there for red herring.
And also, Earl Thomas is going to be back. The defense is going to be better. There's going to be situations that the offense is going to be put in a much better situation, right?
Yeah.
So it's something where, can you remind me, aside from Russell Okung, how different it was when the Seahawks had clearly the best offense in the NFL at the end of the 2015 season? Was it just Russell Okung? Who else was out there?
Well, Carpenter? Lewis was at center.
Patrick Lewis?
Yeah. Because at that point, Britt was still playing right guard.
Badly, right?
I think Lewinsky may have taken over at left guard by that point. I'm not sure. That was a long time ago.
At that point, was anybody talking about the offensive line?
I think people were still talking about the offensive line.
It was the best offense in the NFL.
People need something to complain about, and you can't complain about the
They should talk defense. About the defense. It's like, we can't complain about the defense.
You can't complain about the quarterbacks. You can complain about Jermaine Kearse.
Remember?
They still probably complained about Daryl Bevel, even though the Seahawks had the number one offense in the NFL. Like, that's just always.
They're winning the Super Bowl if Rawls doesn't get hurt. but you're talking about the number one offense in the NFL. Look, the line, if you have a good enough quarterback offense.
No, it's the number one offensive line offense in the NFL despite the offensive line. Despite.
I mean, that might be the case. But to me, lines are overrated.
I don't know if I buy that. I think just the Seahawks offensive line, the importance of the Seahawks offensive line is overrated by Seahawks fans. But in general, I don't think that they are overrated.
Yes, I mean, a lot of blame has to go to Russell Wilson for last year. Or as being injured. I mean, not even blame, right?
Just there doesn't have to be blame. Like, just because you don't win the Super Bowl doesn't mean that you have to start blaming people. Like, the expectations have to be realistic.
Wow. It's coming from somebody who sounds like they don't want to win forever. What about some other positions in free agency?
Well, the other position that they've at this point been linked to anyone Lang was, I think, the only offensive lineman who visited. I think they'll sign someone else.
They've talked to some other players.
Have they?
Yeah, there's a safety who ended up signing with...
Oh, yeah, they were going to get a visit from Wilcox.
J.J. Wilcox?
Who then signed...
Is that who it was?
Yeah. And who then signed in Tampa Bay, I believe. But in terms of players who are still out there... is Jared Cook apparently coming for a visit after the Packers signed Martellus Bennett away from New England to kind of fill his spot. So this is interesting. There's some conflicting statistical evidence on Jared Cook. So on the one hand, Jared Cook wasn't very good last year. He ranked 28th of the 32 tight ends with at least 50 targets in catch percentage at 59% of the passes he was throwing from Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, it's like this Guinness... It's very watery.
Now, Cook does tend to run typically deep patterns for a tight end. He was 8th in yards per catch, so he was average in yards per target. He wasn't bad, but again, he's got Aaron Rodgers. Now, the counterpoint, the other hand is, Rodgers was way more effective with Jared Cook. Alex Gelhar has been tweeting about this, and our listener Ben B has been retweeting him. With Jared Cook, Aaron Rodgers last year, 34 touchdowns, 3 interceptions, a 113.4 passer rating. The Packers went 10-3. And the games Jared Cook missed, 15 touchdowns, 6 interceptions, 92.3 QB rating, a 2-4 record.
But I've still drank 3 of them.
So I don't know. I'm not a big Jared Cook fan. If they get him cheap as a second tight end, sure, whatever. If you're thinking of a long-term replacement for Jimmy Graham, if Jimmy Graham leaves next summer, yeah, I don't buy that at all.
I mean, I guess I don't really understand why they're entertaining Jared Cook, but I'm kind of okay with it.
I mean, again, if the price is right, is with anything.
I kind of like the idea of having another receiving threat tight end out there and somebody who maybe can improvise with Russell Wilson.
Yeah, you obviously can do that in a different way than you could with Aaron Rodgers, who's not very good at that.
He really only had one notable catch for the whole year. It was a hell of a catch, though.
Yeah.
There also are so many receiving options for the Seahawks where it's like, okay, do you want to have that many more tight end sets with a tight end who can't block?
I mean, you do probably want a receiving-minded tight end, but again,
it's Jimmy Graham's not a good enough receiving-minded tight end for you?
They like to keep him in to block.
We're keeping Jimmy Graham in a block?
I'm not doing this. I don't run the
what
offense.
Are you talking about?
You don't think that the Seahawks
they need
have
a more receiving-minded tight end than Jimmy Graham?
I'm saying that I don't know if you've heard this complaint of Seahawks fans. They feel like sometimes the Seahawks don't do the best job of maximizing Jimmy Graham as a weapon in the red zone.
God.
I'm going to introduce this theory to you, which is apparently new to you entirely.
I don't think so. They're just not throwing to him. He's still out there. He's running routes.
Sometimes he's blocking.
They throw it to Curse every time. Aren't you aware of this?
He usually is blocking in those cases as well.
Even when he's the intended receiver.
Exactly. And was the other the two departures for the Seahawks so far in free agency, to quickly turn to that, Steven Hauschka, bid him farewell, a pour some out for Steven Hauschka's Seahawks career, signs in Buffalo for 4 years, $12.4 million, which understandably I think more than the Seahawks were willing to pay for him after last season.
He's an effing kicker. Like, I'm sorry, I don't like kickers. I'm, like, not against the idea of kickers, but I don't become unnaturally attached to kickers.
You don't think that we should get rid of kickers entirely?
I mean, honestly, if they got rid of the entire idea of kicking in the sport, I think, feel like I'd be fine with that. But if you
would, why would they even call it football then?
Good point. I'm not against punting. Look, I'm against I think they should get rid of kickoffs completely.
I agree with you on that.
So then you're just down to extra points and field goals. Come on. But I'm saying that a lot of people get unnaturally obsessed with kickers.
Well, because of the fact that they're a white guy on the roster.
And I'm not somebody who becomes unnaturally obsessed with kickers.
And then the Seahawks also lost Brock Coyle after not tendering him as a restricted free agent line and become unrestricted. He signed with San Francisco. Pretty clear based on the way that they handled injuries at linebacker that the Seahawks had no interest in ever playing him at linebacker in a meaningful role and saw him strictly as a special teamer.
So solid special teams player.
Not stunning that he was able to find a bigger role elsewhere.
So far in free agency, how do you feel overall?
Again, I don't love the Luke Jokel contract.
They still found some depth. But they went out there into a very competitive free agent market.
Like I said, I think that the winning move this year in free agency is not to play.
They more or less didn't play.
And they more or less didn't, no. But we'll see, see what comes up.
They had to give Luke Jokel more money guaranteed than I'm sure the team would have liked, and clearly you would have liked.
Well, it was not more than they were willing to.
What do you mean?
Like, they were willing to do it. I mean, obviously, it was more than they would have liked. They would have liked to pay him the veteran minimum. They would like to pay Russell Wilson the minimum. It was great when we were paying Russell Wilson the minimum. Wasn't that?
We should start doing that again.
Yeah. See what he thinks of it. I mean, CR is making a lot of money.
Yeah. He can make a lot of money after sponsored Instagram posts, things like that.
Yeah.
His Alaska Airlines deal. Yeah. That's mostly in airline tickets for his offensive line, though. But in general, it's not like the Seahawks went out and spent a huge amount of money on a veteran.
No.
Or an aging. Like, to me, if they would have spent a giant amount of money on, like, a 34-year-old tackle and assumed that that was going to fix their...
You could say the Russell Okung contract. You can just call that out.
I was actually taking out Andrew Whitworth, but yeah. The Russell Okung contract is kind of crazy to me also.
Whitworth was less guaranteed money in terms of long-term...
But he's still a much older lineman, right? I think he's a 34-year-old offensive lineman. Like, how much is left in the tank there?
He's basically signing a one-year deal. Like, I mean, it doesn't make sense for the Rams because they're not in position where 1 year is going to make or break them. But, you know, if it helps Jared Goff stay upright next season, then sure.
Sure, okay. But I'm saying that they didn't go out and sign an agent.
It seems like the other teams in the NFC West have not spent particularly wisely in free agency. I mean, I guess Arizona, well, the Chandler Jones contract, they paid the market value.
Yeah, but they also lost Calais Campbell, so thank God. Thank God for Luke Jokel's sake. But they didn't go out and sign an aging offensive lineman. They signed somebody who, if we haven't talked about this, also has upside. I mean, he was the number two pick in the draft. You have to understand, you have to accept.
I think you have to throw that. I mean, throw that.
There's upside there, though, right? There was potential there.
Okay, should they sign Ryan Leaf? Who's the number two pick in the draft?
I don't know.
That was an extreme version of the number two pick. I don't put much stock into that.
But it's something, right?
What I think more is that the being the number two pick in the draft colored his entire career in Jacksonville, because just being a competent offensive lineman isn't enough if you were the number two pick in the draft.
Yes. And it meant that there were extreme expectations on him. Now he's just a guy. Right? Yes. So it's not like the Seahawks went out.
He's just a guy who's making entirely too much money.
It's not that much money. When you look
at it, for his track record. Guys of his ilk are not making $8 million. The guys who are making $8 million are players who are proven offensive linemen.
I don't know if that's true.
I mean, for all what you're talking about, naysaying about TJ Lang, like, he's making $8 million. Now, granted, it's for 3 years and it's largely guaranteed.
Yes. But and we couldn't sign him. We tried to sign him.
Well, if the Seahawks had offered as much as Detroit did, who knows? Maybe the deal would have been different.
And it wouldn't have been different. That was the entire story about this. If they had the exact same offer, he's going to go to the place that he was.
No, but it's clear in his comments today that Detroit increased their offer to beat the Seahawks.
Sure. So. But if they're the same offer, you don't want them paying that money to TJ Lang, though.
I'd rather them pay that money to TJ Lang than to Luke Jokel.
It's over 3 years for a much older offensive lineman.
Yeah, but you're at least getting him for 3 years. Again, if Luke Jokel works out beyond your wildest dreams, then he gets paid next summer.
Then you find money to re-sign him next summer.
Okay, but then you've created no net value. Yes, you've mitigated the risk, but you've also completely eliminated the upside.
The net value is that he's then worth more than the contract that he got this year.
How much more can he possibly be worth? You think he's going to be a Pro Bowl offensive lineman this year? Is that your... What are the odds?
It's not unheard of. What are the odds that... Okay, first off, offensive line in the Pro Bowl is not judged by ability whatsoever and is just judged by reputation.
That's fine.
Second off...
Okay, what do you think of the odds he's one of the five best whatever position he ends up playing in the NFL this year? What are the odds of that? Like 5%?
Maybe a little bit more. 10%.
That's exceedingly optimistic. One of his track record.
I don't think his track record is that bad. He's just injured.
You know what? I'm going to take your bold prediction. Luke Jokel will not finish the season on the Seahawks roster.
Hello, there we go. I've goaded you into a bold prediction here. He's going to finish the season on the roster. There's no need to release him. What do they save? They save nothing by releasing it.
What did they save by releasing any of the players they released previously? What did they save by releasing Jamarcus Webb last year?
They didn't have $7 million guaranteed. That's what they saved.
That's a sunk cost. That's the whole point of it being a one-year contract, is you're not having to incur a future cap hit by releasing it.
But Luke Jokel
you're just
has
going to guard
very
him, judge
little
him
beyond
based on his merit,
guaranteed money.
And what indication is there that he's necessarily going to merit a spot on the roster?
You're not understanding that we're going to give all credit for the regression to the mean to Luke Jokel.
Fans are going to. I don't think Pete Carroll is going to.
He's going to be like, give all this credit to George Fant. You wouldn't believe the strides he's making as a backup offensive line. He'd be like, he's got something special. Wow. Bold prediction that Luke Jokel is not going to finish the season on the team.
This is a too bold prediction, podcast. I did not expect that.
Wait, what was the first bold prediction?
Sidney Jones to Cleveland.
Oh, that was a good bold prediction. I always said my bold prediction was that he'd get drafted higher than people thought, but you went out and named a team.
I saw your bold prediction. I erased it.
Wow. I did not realize how anti this Jokel contract you are.
I'm not that anti it.
Yeah, you clearly
you're
are
like
that
it
anti.
Like, oh, what a brilliant signing!
I'm saying it's not that bad. I'm saying they mostly sat out this free agency, and I was worried that they'd do something irrational, completely irrational.
I mean, when you just spend a third of your cap space on someone, you've done something.
Wow.
Like, there's an alternative cost here.
What is the alternative cost?
What else you could have gotten for spending $8 million?
But what is that? Maybe they looked at the market and said, look, we have these running backs available to us. If they want to sign a running back, they have running backs available to them for basically nothing. They're going to draft a cornerback in the first round of the draft. That's it.
I mean, I'm pretty sure they could have found something to spend their $8 million on.
I don't know what that is. I mean, like, would they have paid TJ Lang a little bit more to pay, like, wasteful guaranteed money to him 2 and 3 years down the line?
But again, there's at least some potential value to it because of the fact you got him under contract for 3 years. Jokel is
more,
one and done.
More guaranteed money, though. And if he's bad, you're giving up guaranteed money for 2 and 3 years out.
But there's more reason to believe that TJ Lang will be good because he has actually been good in the past.
I'm skeptical about that. How do you even judge offensive linemen? It's such a ridiculous way.
I mean, people manage to do it. I mean, it's not like there's no, there is correlation between what players make and their, like, I just don't
believe.
Okay,
you just made $7 million.
I don't.
You want correlation right there. Boom, you've got it.
I am unconvinced that another team was willing to offer anywhere close to what the Seahawks were willing to offer for Luke Jokel. I mean, I think probably someone was willing to offer more over 2 years and they overpaid to get the 1 year contract. But I've explained why I don't think 1 year contracts are a smart investment of resources when you're paying someone that much money.
What about when you have George Fant behind him?
Then just play George Fant if you're actually that convinced that
George I had my choice, I would have gone in. It's been well documented. I wanted this team to go into next year with the exact same offensive line.
Yeah, I was not that dramatic. I want an upgrade at right tackle. I don't think Gary Gilliam is a starting caliber right tackle.
Then what do you do? How do you find this upgrade at right tackle?
I mean,
who is it? Is it somebody in the draft?
I don't know specifically.
This is like the most contentious we've ever been. It was kind of randomly out of nowhere. Like, I don't even know how many minutes into this we are. I feel like we're not even recording a podcast anymore. We're just arguing with each other.
I don't scout offensive linemen for a living. And maybe Luke Jokel is really great. But no one else in the world besides the Seahawks seems to think that.
We don't know that.
I mean, where are the reports of the mystery team who was a suitor for Luke Jokel? Where was the other team that had Luke Jokel in for a visit? You don't think that even that is relevant?
Okay. So there were no other teams who were even talking to Luke Jokel. I'm telling you, there was money for linemen this year. They went in, they had to go into the market that was most coveted.
They didn't, again, they didn't have to go into that market.
But they realized that last year.
There are
year,
also still guys who are out there.
Who?
I mean, Brian Clady?
Brian Schwanke just got signed.
I'm aware that he did. You know, King Dunlap has legal issues, and who knows what that situation is going to be. And he hasn't been very good, but he's not going to require $8 million to sign. That's for
damn sure. They should bring him in. Cut him before the season.
They could still cut several guys before the season.
You never know.
Plenty of time.
I was going to say that my bold prediction, when I saw the guaranteed money for Luke Jokel, I decided that I was not going to boldly predict that they would cut him before the season started. No. But you went there. You guess you said before the end of the season.
Yes.
Normally, I would say that any free agent that the Seahawks signed, I would boldly predict that they're going to not end the season on the team.
Well, I look forward to you predicting that when the Seahawks sign Adrian Peterson.
Oh, there's no chance of him ending the season with the team. No, they'll stick him on IR after like week 3.
Yeah. Save some face. All right, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.